The story behind the headlines. Every Sunday evening at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, presents Caesar Searchinger in his analysis of the news. In this analysis, Mr. Searchinger draws upon research material especially prepared for these broadcasts by eminent historians. And now, Caesar Searchinger.
Good evening, everybody. The great Allied offensive on the Western Front, now in its fifth day, may be General Eisenhower's bid to bring about Germany's collapse this winter. Perhaps we shall know more about its objectives this time next week. Meantime, the fate of Germany and of Europe is being settled in stages in a series of diplomatic moves, of which the invitation of General de Gaulle to Moscow is the latest, and another conference of the Big Three may be the next. The Roosevelt-Churchill conference at Quebec, preceded by Mr. Churchill's lengthy visit to Rome, the Churchill-Stalin conference at Moscow, and Mr. Churchill's dramatic Armistice Day visit to Paris, all these were steps in the shaping of the Europe that is to emerge from this war. At Moscow, though obliged to bypass the stubborn Polish problem, the two dominant European powers virtually settled the future of Eastern Europe. At Paris, on Armistice Day, a long step was taken toward a settlement in the West. For France was formally accepted into the higher councils, which deals with European problems, namely the European Advisory Commission. Hitherto, all the decisions had been made by the Big Three, Great Britain, Russia, and the United States, all powers with major interests outside of Europe. The addition of France gives greater representation to the continent itself, though France, too, owns one of the greatest non-European empires in the world. With one exception, these are the same powers which tried to settle the fate of Europe after World War I. The one exception was Soviet Russia, whose temporary departure from Europe left a vacuum which sooner or later had to be filled. The attempt to fill it with Italy was not exactly a success. Italy was a latecomer in the war and took an early departure when our aspirations were not fulfilled. Today we are back to the original combination which came together in the days before the First World War. It started with the Entente Cordiale in the days of Edward VII, and this became the Triple Entente when Tsarist Russia was finally accepted by the liberal British statesmen of 1907. Fear of Germany had driven England first to the side of France, then to the side of Russia as well. Had Germany been defeated by these three powers, the new map of Europe would have been drawn by Russia, Britain, and France alone. But Russia dropped out of the fight in 1917, and the United States filled the gap. When America refused to guarantee the new Europe which she had helped to build, she left a gap which later became a gaping void. Is history repeating itself in reverse? Is Churchill rebuilding the Entente Cordiale, to be followed by the Triple Entente when de Gaulle travels to Moscow to see Stalin? Some drastic changes have taken place in Europe since the days of the First Entente. Today, Russia, having driven the invader from her soil, emerges as the greatest military power that Europe has ever seen. Russia has conquered all of Germany's former satellites and harnessed them to her chariot, all but one, and that one, Hungary, is also on the verge of collapse. The shape of Eastern Europe is being determined very largely by the armistice terms with these former Axis satellite states. The terms are not punitive, but rational on the whole. They are unusual in that they provide for territorial changes, reparations, and other matters usually reserved for treaties of peace. The territorial changes give Russia certain strategic advantages, and otherwise they revert to the pre-war boundaries of the nations concerned. Thus, the agreement with Bulgaria obliges that country to return to Greece the maritime province of Thrace. Had it remained Bulgarian, it would have given Bulgaria her former access to the Aegean Sea, and that, in the long run, would have redounded to Russia's benefit, for Bulgaria is expected to be very friendly to Russia, to say the least. Thus, Russia is apparently no nearer to her historic aspiration for an outlet to the Mediterranean than she was before the war, unless some kind of agreement was reached between Stalin and Churchill with regard to the future of the Turkish Straits. We may not be far wrong in guessing that this was one of the subjects discussed in the recent Moscow talks. We do know that the future of two Mediterranean countries was pretty well settled for the immediate future, namely Yugoslavia and Greece. Both Russia and Britain are recognized as having an interest in Yugoslavia, while Greece is to remain in the British sphere as it was before the war. What we do not know is what effect this will have on the internal political structure of these countries after the war. Will they remain monarchies as Britain hopes, or will they turn red republican as seems to be indicated from our correspondence on the spot? It is perfectly true, of course, that Russia has pledged herself not to interfere with the social structure of the countries she invades, and appears determined to keep the pledge. Nevertheless, we see political shifts in the governments of Finland, Romania, and Bulgaria already, generally speaking, towards the left, with communist participation, though only in minor roles. Considering the trend of political thought in these countries before the rise of fascism, it's an easy guess which way they will turn, with or without encouragement from Moscow. The same, incidentally, is true of Greece, which is said to be completely dominated by the leftist EAM, or National Liberation Front, and Yugoslavia, where Marshal Tito's partisans command a similarly powerful influence. In Czechoslovakia, the first friendly neighbor to enter a military alliance with Soviet Russia, the democratic forces are known to be strong and predominantly left-wing. In Poland, the struggle between the left-wing parties supporting the Lublin Committee of Liberation and the conservative and mildly liberal groups following the London cabinet is still being fought out. The latest visit of Premier Mikulajczyk has brought a compromise no nearer, despite the intervention of Mr. Churchill and Marshal Stalin. But few would dare to predict any solution which would not permit the closest political collaboration with Soviet Russia after the war. The political complexion of Eastern Europe, east of a line from somewhere on the Baltic to the head of the Adriatic, seems destined to be from red to pink, not necessarily because Moscow wants it to be, but because that is the natural long-term trend, and Soviet Russia could not disavow its own revolution, even if it wished to. The countries which after the last war were to form a cordon sanitaire against Bolshevism today must look to Russia for protection and leadership. Now, what about Western Europe? In Western Europe, there are constitutional monarchies like Belgium and Holland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, with governments all the way from conservative to socialist. There is Italy, which on the rebound from fascism seems to lean to a socialist, communist, popular front. There are fascist Spain and Portugal, still favored by some statesmen as an anchor of stability in the West. And there's France, which is politically still uncommitted, and whose leadership might determine the future course in all of Western Europe. General de Gaulle, now the acknowledged leader, is a man without a party, but he has already had to make concessions to the left. The resistance movement contains elements of all parties, but it is already split into left and right. The old political alignments are reappearing, and the communists are taking a strong opposition line. The youngsters of the FFI, the resistance movement, the Maquis and partisan groups, speak of a second revolution. Minister Bidault, Georges Bidault, who was and still is the head of the resistance council, speaks of a revolution by law. At this critical moment, the Allies have recognized General de Gaulle's provisional government and have assured to France her place as one of the big four. It might have come sooner if the necessity of a stable and unrevolutionary France in Western Europe had been recognized by certain parties. On Armistice Day, Prime Minister Churchill stressed in Paris that a strong French army, as soon as possible, was absolutely necessary to balance and sanity in Europe. France was promised her share of the triumph over Germany and her place in the Supreme Councils of Europe just at the moment when the revolutions threatened to get out of hand. Patriotism and national pride have often proved antidotes to revolutionary unrest and have been deliberately used for that purpose. A good deal has been said during the recent months about the possibility of a Western European bloc. Field Marshal Smuts was the first to speak of it publicly, then General de Gaulle. Foreign Secretary Eden has mentioned negotiations looking to that end with several nations. The Churchill visit to Paris, besides revitalizing the old Entente, has been regarded as a step towards the Western bloc. The most striking political tendency, said the French Foreign Minister, Georges Bidault, is toward an alliance of the Western powers. Yet now we hear that Soviet Russia has frowned upon this idea, just as she frowned upon the proposed Polish-Czechoslovak pact some time ago. Whenever an alliance of European nations is mooted, the Russians feel that it might someday be turned against them. That is the legacy of the bad old days of the Munich Pact. Yet today, Russia herself is creating a zone of friendly states in Eastern Europe. Her alliance with Czechoslovakia is open for neighboring states to join. These are indications of something like a unification of Europe from the East. What then would be the objection of a combination to a combination of federation in the West? Such a combination would be based on a close alliance between Britain and France. It would include the Low Countries, Belgium and Holland, and most likely the Scandinavian countries too. But what about Switzerland, regarded by Russia as an unfriendly nation? What about Italy, whose ideological allegiance is still uncertain? And what about the fascist countries on Europe's western fringe? What about Germany, which for years may be occupied in separate regions by the Big Four? There are quite obviously many points to be settled before the outlines of a stable Europe can become clear. Since time immemorial, Europe has struggled to find an equilibrium that would give her nations peace. For centuries, the best she has been able to evolve is a system of balance of power between wars. Empires have risen on the continent, each successively trying to impose its hegemony or to unify the continent by conquest. And for the past three centuries, England has frustrated every attempt at domination by throwing her strength on the side of the lesser powers. Today, the greatest power on the continent is Soviet Russia, and Great Britain is allied to the strongest power. She has therefore abandoned her historic role as balancer. Will these two great world powers, as leaders of the two great world regions, be able to stabilize the continent by peaceful agreement now that the last of the troublemakers of the past two or three centuries is bound to be eliminated? It doesn't seem likely that they can do it alone. It doesn't appear that all the problems can be solved in conference between Stalin and Churchill alone. Many matters could not be settled, said Churchill after the recent Moscow conference, in the absence of the president. This is but a recognition of a condition that already existed at the end of World War I, namely the incapability of Europe to find her equilibrium alone. Today, the world has become so interdependent that there are no international problems that can be solved on a regional basis. The elimination of Germany as a military power will not be enough. Any permanent solution of Europe's problems involves the rational disposal and employment of Europe's resources and industrial power. It also involves the fruitful cooperation of two radically different schools of economy, and it involves a world political structure in which democracy and communism can live peacefully side by side. In the solution of these world problems, the help of the United States is obviously indispensable. That is why the Moscow conference was only a stopgap and must be followed by an early conference of the Big Three or even the Big Four, which now seems to include France. Good night.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, have presented Caesar Searchinger. Next Sunday at this time, Mr. Searchinger will be back with another story behind the headlines. This is the National Broadcasting Company.